Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The decision by many countries to release prisoners to slow the transmission of new coronavirus has been welcomed by the UN's top rights official, Michelle Bachelet. The development comes after the High Commissioner's appeal last week to reduce overcrowding in detention centres. But on Friday, her spokesperson, Rupert Colville, urged states to release every person detained without sufficient legal basis, including political prisoners and those detained for critical dissenting views.
In a number of countries that are doing very large prisoner releases have not necessarily been releasing those types of prisoners, and that includes Iran. They have released some, but not others. And Egypt, as we said, hasn't released hardly anyone yet.
Mr. Colville said that Iran had increased its prisoner release to around 100,000 inmates, representing 40% of the entire prison population. He also noted that Indonesia announced that it would free 30,000 prisoners convicted of minor crimes, including drug use, while Turkey is also understood to be considering a similar measure. Concerns remain about Syrian detainees, however, where the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has described the situation in all official prisons and makeshift detention facilities as alarming. Before the COVID-19 outbreak, it warned of overcrowding in central prisons and in facilities run by four government security branches as civil war rages. Reports from the UN office highlighted deaths in these facilities, including as a result of torture and denial of medical care. In Sudan, aid is to be stepped up in response to COVID-19 restrictions to protect the more than 9 million people there in need of humanitarian assistance, including victims of gender-based violence. 7 cases of infection, including 2 deaths of new coronavirus, have been confirmed in the country, all of which came from abroad, according to the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. Although workshops and awareness-raising sessions on gender-based violence have been suspended, confidential services have been maintained. OCHA spokesperson Jens Laka said the UN is aware that the rise in domestic abuse linked to COVID-19 curfews was happening in Sudan like anywhere else.
Alarm, frankly, has been raised about increase of gender-based violence because of confinement at home. That is an issue. Individual counseling and referrals, for example, to health facilities and gender-based violence confidential corner services, so where women can speak in confidence to counselors, that continues.
Among the emergency measures in response to COVID-19, UN partners are planning to distribute 2 to 3 months of food rations at one time. This will limit the number of times people gather for food and reduce the potential for the virus to spread. To reduce exposure of malnourished children to the coronavirus, more ready-to-use therapeutic food will also be available to reduce the need to visit nutrition centres. OCHA is also developing guidelines and procedures to make sure that health workers can continue to deliver immunization, nutritional supplements, and maintain infant and young child feeding programs. Finally, the first resolution passed by the UN General Assembly since the new coronavirus outbreak began has stressed the need for international cooperation to overcome COVID-19. The resolution, approved by consensus in New York on Thursday, also highlighted the need to respect human rights and the central role of United Nations agencies in combating the disease. It said that there was no place for discrimination, racism, and xenophobia in response to the pandemic, which has so far seen around 1 million confirmed cases and claimed more than 50,000 lives. Although General Assembly decisions are not binding in the same way as Security Council resolutions, the forum is an opportunity for all 193 UN member states to raise issues of concern. The text was submitted by Switzerland, Indonesia, Singapore, Norway, Liechtenstein, and Ghana. Reportedly, it had the backing of 188 nations. A parallel resolution sponsored by Russia was not successful. It addressed the issue of lifting international sanctions to halt the spread of the disease. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Well, coming up next is Ben Norton interviewing Moderate Rebels. It's a great podcast. It's part of the Gray Zone Project with Max Blumenthal and company. This is a transcontinental interview between Moderate Rebels and Asia Times reporter, and he writes for Consortium News also, Pepe Escobar. He's written all over the place. Conducted March 27th, 2020, and it's revealing in the discussion about the origins of the coronavirus pandemic, and it's very interesting. You have to listen to it carefully. We'll get to some vintage music tomorrow on Sunday, and more good stuff. Our regular programming, but this is sort of the extended interview, so enjoy.
This is Moderate Rebels. I'm Ben Norton, and I'm here in Nicaragua right now, and Max is in D.C. under quarantine, and we have the privilege of being joined by one of the best geopolitical analysts today, who's in Thailand. So we're all really in entirely different regions of the world, and we're going to talk about something today that is affecting every region of the world, the coronavirus pandemic. You know, people have really lost their minds, in some cases rightfully, in some cases in the case of the U.S., you have all these people for some reason buying endless reams of toilet paper. But what's interesting is to see the responses of different governments. The Chinese government, where it's suspected, or at least it originally was suspected, that the coronavirus pandemic began, although actually there are reasons to be suspicious of that narrative now, the Chinese government has successfully contained the outbreak. Meanwhile, in the U.S., which is now the United States is now really the heart of the outbreak, and in New York, the cases are doubling by the day, and the U.S. government has not really taken the aggressive measures that China took. So today, we're going to put particular emphasis on what the response of China was, what the response of the U.S. and France and other countries has been, and also how these countries, especially the U.S., are using this as a kind of geopolitical weapon. And Pepe just published an amazing article, which we'll link to in the show notes for this episode, at the Asia Times. It's called China Locked in Hybrid War with U.S. So Pepe, thanks so much for joining us. I'll cut to you now. Can you just give us some kind of introductory thoughts here and what you think's going on?
Thanks very much, guys. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Max. It's a great pleasure to be with you guys. Really, great
to have you.
You're doing an absolutely outstanding job.
Thank you.
And it's my pleasure.
Thank you. The admiration is mutual.
From Asia, which is my it's one of my two homes. I am a commuter. Well, until now, because we're all grounded, right? Between Europe and Asia, for 25 years, I've been living between East and West. My base in Asia is Thailand. Used to be Singapore in the beginning. For a long time was Hong Kong as well. So I've been following everything that's happening in Asia for the past quarter of a century, which implies the whole Chinese miracle story started with the Asian Tigers miracle in the 90s. Then the big Chinese story especially for the past 20 years, the war on terror from a pan-Asian perspective as well, which includes Southwest Asia, which we in the West call the Middle East, erroneously, of course. And of course, when I'm in Europe, I follow NATO, Brussels, EU, that Kafka apparel. It's worse than Kafka, actually, from a Brussels point of view, but also from a Parisian and Italian point of view. So, yes, I am a nomad, like I told Ben before, which helps to understand this, what is being configured in the West usually as a clash of civilizations, which is not. It's cross-culture, in fact. It's Greek-Latin civilization, the new empire that pretends to be an heir to the Roman Empire, the ascension of the old empires across Eurasia. So it helps to... If you keep an open mind, it's all there. You just need to listen to people. You need to be tolerant. You need to be patient. And of course, when we have characters like Mike Pompeo, etc., uttering their fallacies, that drives you crazy on a daily basis. But, you know, and I try to heal all that, rereading the pre-Socratics philosophy. I am a smashed former philosophy PhD who decided to go to London to listen to the Clash and the Jam at the time. So, you know, my options were musical instead of philosophical. But, you know, to start talking about our major game-changing theme, The theme of hybrid war, in fact, which was, as you know, conceptualized in American think tanks, and then they start selling the idea that the Russians came up with it, which is not true at all. It's what they have been trying to reframe and reorganize for the past few years. First applied to the color revolutions, and now applied to what the Pentagon on the record qualifies as the three major threats to America: Russia, China, and Iran. Well, in my own case, I happen to be very close to the three of them. I go to China a lot, I go to Iran a lot, and I go to Russia a lot. So the only way to understand how they think is to go there and to talk to their analysts, their scholars, the think tanks, etc., politicians, etc. And in terms of the hybrid war detonated by the U.S., by the Trump administration and the deep state at the same time against China, and now it has reached unbelievable proportions, in fact. And obviously, if we start thinking in CIA terms, CIA label, conspiracy theories, we can go on forever. So sticking to facts, what the Trump administration has been hurling at the Chinese, especially since the beginning of the Trump trade war, has accomplished something that I thought it would not happen for at least for the next 10 or 15 years. Chinese diplomacy used to be passive and reactive. Now it's active. And now they are not mincing their words anymore. And we had the best example a few days ago with that famous tweet that reverberated around the world by a Chinese diplomat, basically asking the Americans to come clean about the origins of coronavirus. And when you have this, the way it was set up by a mid-level Chinese diplomat, but part of the Ministry of Foreign Relations. So this is officially official Chinese diplomacy. So this has to be cleared right at the top, not only with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, which is one of the best in the world alongside Lavrov and Zarif, but it will have to be cleared by the whole Politburo, in fact, because this is basically a Chinese official challenging the American version of the most important story of the 21st century head on. So no wonder this drove not only the Trump administration, but also the deep states to they freaked out completely. And you've seen the responses these past few days. Wuhan virus, Chinese virus. Yesterday, when they were writing the draft for the G7 final communique, which, by the way, never happened, Pompeo was trying to force the other ministers to include Wuhan virus.
They didn't come to an agreement specifically because the U.S. refused to sign the agreement unless they called it the Wuhan virus, which is insane behavior. That is a textbook example of a rogue state.
And I heard from Brussels diplomats these past 24 hours. In fact, they were saying, this is complete. Now they lost the plot completely. And in fact, they lost even what the semblance of allies that they had inside the EU. Nowadays, I would say, apart from Germany, which is a very complicated case, but the club mat countries, And France, which is very important because France and Germany counterbalance the decision process in Brussels, they are completely against anything that comes from especially from the U.S. Department, State Department. So they are isolating themselves. They don't care, of course. What drives Pompeo is something really psychotic. There's no other definition for it. And counterproductive for so-called American interests, right? And what they are discussing today, as you speak, at the G20, the virtual G20. I wonder if anything really meaningful will come out of it, because we're going to see, once again, U.S. against China at the heart of the G20. And we have people at the G20 that are absolutely, can you imagine Erdogan and Bolsonaro making decisions that affect the whole planet together on a G20 meeting? It's, wow. Come on. This is Saturday Night Live stuff, right?
Yeah. It's funnier than Saturday Night Live.
It's funnier.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live hasn't been funny.
Which isn't saying much.
Tragic.
It's not saying much. I mean, you know, but this is sort of, you know, Saturday Night Live's like theater for, you know, culturally deprived 14-year-olds who are stuck at home. This is, you know, theater for those of us who are extremely fatalistic and are stuck under self-quarantine watching the world meltdown. But when we say the world, I mean, what do we really mean? I think there is a hunger for cooperation at this juncture among most countries, but we've seen the U.S. just in the past week, well, just in the past 2 hours, I should say, the U.S. just labeled Venezuela a state sponsor of terrorism and a narco-trafficking state, you know, shades of Panama, really setting the stage for a Panama-style intervention, the kind of which the Venezuelan Guaido mafia has been begging for. We have seen the U.S. yesterday demand that countries refuse Cuban assistance and declare that Cuban doctors are, you know, basically victims of human trafficking. I think 5 days ago, Mike Pompeo, you know, this kind of human caricature of a fat bankster, sort of like he's like a walking embodiment of Bolshevik propaganda against the Nazi regime. You know, he announced tightened sanctions on Iran. I don't know what else there is to sanction. They can sanction toilet paper rolls, so they have to come out as just sheets. I don't know what there is left there, but we're seeing, in my view, and now, sorry, I missed one. 7 hours ago, Woody Johnson, the U.S. ambassador to the U.K., who's not actually a diplomat, he's actually the former owner of the New York Jets, who just donated a ton of money to Trump to buy an ambassadorship. He just accused China of hostile propaganda, blamed China for allowing the virus to spread, the coronavirus to spread. Of course, you know, we can just look at U.S. media headlines for the last few weeks and months about how China was taking the wrong approach by being so aggressive against the virus, how China's quarantines were all wrong, and, you know, just to know how ridiculous and disingenuous the Trump administration's accusations are. But this is part of a Trump administration-wide strategy emanating from the National Security Council to turn up the heat on China. I guess I want to focus here on China, but I wanted to set the stage with this kind of intensification of hybrid warfare. It seems obvious to me, and I wonder if you agree, number one, that the U.S. is taking the opportunity of coronavirus, of COVID-19, to intensify hybrid warfare. These aren't happenstance incidents that I just listed. And number two, it does seem that we, and as you wrote, I think your piece was at Consortium News originally, as you wrote, that we've entered a new phase and a more intense phase of the new Cold War between the U.S. and China, with Chinese diplomats actually, you know, verbally retaliating against all of this rhetoric from the Trump administration.
It's absolutely correct, Max. And I was saying before that I would not expect this to happen before 2030. So once again, I think COVID-19 was a sort of a particle accelerator, like the one that they have at the CERN in Geneva. You know, accelerating a Cold War 2.0 particles as well. And I'm sure this was a concerted Politburo decision. There's no question about that. Because there was a split in the Politburo until maybe 2 or 3 months ago. The majority was against Xi Jinping, in fact, according to our best information.
Right.
They were thinking that Xi was too accommodating vis-a-vis Trump. Phone calls, meetings, blah, 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 you know. And these guys are old school Maoists or crypto Maoists. You know, it's a completely different thing. They say no. It's like they were remembering that famous Mao saying from 1949 that the imperialists will never convert into Buddhas, which is one of his best lines ever. And I said, look, we have to know exactly who we're dealing with. They are coming to get us because they were always paying very close attention to the national security strategy by the rhetoric coming from all corners in the U.S., that this is a bipartisan issue coming from the U.S., by the trying to shift the blame off the trade war itself towards China. And now with COVID-19, with the concerted campaign, Wuhan virus, Chinese virus, this is more than obvious. So what happened with that tweet only a few days ago? It's the beginning of a new wave, which is unexpected for all of us. Even, people who have been inside China for 20, 30 years. I talked to some think tank people in Beijing, and they said, we were not expecting that at all. Of course, when you talk to think tank guys from China, they have to respect the official line, but it's what they don't say that sends you messages. You know, and the way they were saying it, the way they were announcing the new strategy is more as, yes, we're going to be more assertive, which in Chinese terms means hardcore, really, because before it was passive, reactive, and they have as you know very well, they have a tremendous soft power problem.
Yeah.
So now they're going to start communicating more and more on the net in English directly. I wouldn't be surprised if sooner or later we're going to have those press conferences at the Ministry of Foreign Relations in Beijing in English as well, because they want to reach the planet, and they know now is the right time, because now they can sell a story with a very convincing narrative. Yes, this was a pandemic from the beginning. We didn't know what it was in the beginning when it hit us. It took us a while to understand what was going on, and that explains what happened in that crucial timeline from the moment, the exact date, in fact, that the Chinese identified this was a new disease. This was, I have my dates here, December 30th, when they told the Chinese CDC and the World Health Organization, December 30th, that this was a new disease and that they had identified, and they would need to start fighting it with, and they still didn't know exactly how. And they start their fight in January. It took 2 months. It was very drastic, and they are winning it.
Yeah.
And this is a very solid fact-based narrative. And, and they're starting to not only to sell this narrative, but to bring pieces of the narrative to nations in Europe, which is, that China Eastern flight arriving in Milan with masks, ventilators, 10 or 11 doctors, first-class doctors to help the people in Lombardy. The help that they are sending to other countries in Europe as well. So, and it's amazing because even in Brussels, as you know, is very Atlanticist. 95% in Brussels are Atlanticist. They're starting to recognize what's going on. They're starting to recognize that these missions sent by the Russians, for instance, 15, 16 military planes full of equipment, doctors, etc., the Chinese helped, especially to Italy in the beginning, now to many EU nations. This is a geopolitical game changer, And they compare, right away they compare, what is America doing for us?
Yeah, quick note for our listeners.
Yeah.
A quick note for our listeners here, just so if they don't know the term. By Atlanticist, Pepe, you mean people largely in Europe who see their political and economic allies as a bloc with the U.S. as opposed to looking eastward toward Asia.
Yes, absolutely.
The reaction in Italy, where we're seeing some citizens kind of, you know, do these sort of staged social media videos where they replace EU flags with Russian flags or with Chinese flags, and we're seeing some kind of a freak out from centrist Atlanticist Italian media. La Stampa has a piece out denouncing a Russian intervention and saying they don't need it. And that kind of it reminds me of the Trump Putin summit when CNN put out a piece right after Putin handed Trump a soccer ball that the soccer ball could contain surveillance devices. It's just like the sheer pettiness of just rejecting even a soccer ball made me wonder how the U.S. would react if we got some much needed Russian soft power in the form of N95 masks and doctors, where you have people in New York City at Presbyterian Hospital waiting from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. with high fevers just to get tested for coronavirus. It's pretty clear that we're seeing a titanic geopolitical shift. I want to get into that later, but I want to put something up front here that we haven't really, I don't think we've taken head on, but you did in your piece for Consortium News, which is that Chinese diplomats, what is his name? Li Jianzhao. Yeah. And he's sort of the most aggressive in English on Twitter, have actually not only stated that their belief that the COVID-19 coronavirus, novel coronavirus, did not originate in China, but that it may have originated from a U.S. bioweapons lab, specifically Fort Detrick, which is near me. Fort Detrick is in Frederick, Maryland, and it is a bioweapons facility. I mean, it's considered a research facility. It's where anthrax was allegedly manufactured around 9/11, but it's also the source of Lyme disease, where deer who were being experimented on escaped. And if you look at local news reports, just go on YouTube and look up Fort Detrick, you'll find news reports from local Maryland media, either in Baltimore or in Frederick, about various cancer clusters in the area and residents panicking about the lab poisoning them over the years. I don't know. I don't see any evidence or any basis for these claims, but they tack them on to a Event 201 pandemic simulation, which was run, I think, on October 13th, 2019, sponsored by the Gates Foundation. I watched 2 hours of the simulation last night. You know, you have the Gates Foundation basically sitting right next to the deputy director of the CDC. You have the Chinese CDC there. You have a representative of Singapore. You have a former NSC person from the U.S. I think the CIA was involved, but it's mainly a Gates Foundation simulation. Of course, the Gates Foundation is the second leading sponsor of the World Health Organization. It's basically privatizing this idea of global governance. And on that same day in Wuhan, there was a military exercise that the U.S. participated in. And so we've seen from the Chinese diplomatic corps an indulgence in what could be described as a conspiracy theory, that on the same day that an exercise at Fort Detrick was shut down by the CDC because various contaminants were getting into the community, the Wuhan, I'm getting the timeline wrong. On the same day of Event 201, where they simulated a pandemic, which essentially is COVID-19. I mean, they described it to a T in this simulation.
Exactly. It was a SARS virus.
It's frightening how accurate they predicted exactly what we're facing now, down to shortages of N95 masks and problems with the supply line and panic, hoarding. I mean, they predicted it all. And on that same day, there was the Wuhan military exercise. So I'm wondering why are they, I mean, are they just indulging in conspiracism in order to fuck with the U.S., just to screw with Mike Pompeo's mind and to upset the U.S. and troll the U.S. or do they actually believe this? And if so, why is there no concrete evidence that they're putting forward? Because I haven't seen any substance to it.
No, the Chinese leadership doesn't see this as a conspiracy theory at all. They were following the timeline. They know the timeline by heart by now, like all of us journalists do. For Dietrich,
I gotta say, most journalists don't know that event. Because most journalists are imperial bootlickers.
when I say us, independent, of course, exactly. The Wuhan military games, which now in China, everybody now has an opinion about the Wuhan military games. This is part of one of my next columns, in fact, which is I've been postponing it because I don't want to write it as a conspiracy theory. I want to write it as a work hypothesis. And this is the work hypothesis that the Chinese leadership is considering. They don't have a smoking gun. Nobody has a smoking gun. But there are too many coincidences. If you follow this timeline, especially when we get to Wuhan in late October, for instance, it was found that five members of the 300-strong military delegation, they had something that looked like a severe pneumonia, and they were treated at a hospital in Wuhan. They were staying in a hotel, the Wuhan Oriental Hotel, which is 300 meters away from the site of the games. They were very close to the famous seafood market. So it's not that the Chinese are saying this happened like this. They are examining what very serious possibility that, you know, within this very circumscripted area, something might have happened. And these people were treated, five military, American military, were treated at the hospital. People who treated them at the hospital were contaminated. Very important information. And some people at the hotel, at the Wuhan Oriental Hotel, were also contaminated. So this is an information that is largely available in China, but not in U.S., and not in Western media. So, you know, when they start putting all this together, they tend to reach a conclusion that, look, something happened. We don't know exactly where, but there are too many coincidences. You see? And now there's some extra strand coming out of Italy, which is very, very, very interesting.
Well, wait one second. Before we move on to the genetic basis of the virus, there's also another detail we didn't even mention, which is that the head of Harvard's chemistry program was arrested by the FBI after coming back on numerous trips to Wuhan, where he was having regular meetings at these Wuhan's labs. So there's just so many.
He was bringing vials to Wuhan.
It is. It's very good that you pointed this out, Ben, because we are in touch with Dr. Francis Boyle, who has an explosive theory that this is in fact a bioweapon. He says it doesn't have a smoking gun, but according to everything that he knows, and he is an authority in the matter, he says this is a bioweapon. And according to his first working hypothesis, let's put it this way, it actually escaped from the P4 lab in Wuhan. But now he is revising it, and he sees some dodgy things happening, and maybe with the involvement of foreign scientists.
Boyle's original theory was that it was produced at a bioweapons lab in Wuhan, which actually we've also heard this theory put forward by the arch neoconservative in the Senate, Tom Cotton. But according to Boyle, it was produced with cooperation from, I believe, Australian and Norwegian or American scientists. I mean, I haven't watched Boyle describe it, but this is someone who said they were basically blackballed after tracing anthrax to Fort Dietrich.
No, just to finish this.
Yeah.
What happened in Lombardy is that, and this is a guy who starts to appear a lot on Italian TV. I saw some of his interviews on Italian TV, and this was mistranslated in even in American media, if somebody in American media talked about it. I know it was mistranslated in the South China Morning Post, my neighbors here in Hong Kong. He said that he started to talk with general practitioners in the Lombardy region around Milano. And they were saying that starting in October 2019, and then in November and December as well, they started to see cases of a really, really strong pneumonia that they haven't seen before, which leads us to, and leads him to believe that perhaps the virus was already around Lombardy in October, simultaneously to Wuhan. And that makes sense because the strands, this has been already proven that the strands in Lombardy and in Wuhan are different. And there are other studies saying that there are 5 strands of coronavirus. C is the only one found in Wuhan initially. Yeah. This means that A and B were from somewhere else. This somewhere else is very vague. So there are not many candidates, right? But the point is, very, very serious studies are saying that, in fact, one of them published at The Lancet, saying that the virus might have not originated in Wuhan. So right. We have so many clashing working hypotheses, you know. Number one thing, you cannot say with absolute certainty, like the Trump administration is saying, that this is a Wuhan virus or Chinese virus. This is still open to an enormous scientific discussion, an epidemiological study in depth, and we're not going to have this in a matter of a few weeks. These studies take months, sometimes over a year.
And the video that the Chinese Foreign Ministry on Twitter was pointing to was a video of a congressional hearing in the U.S. in which a top CDC official said that acknowledged that it might have been possible that for weeks before coronavirus, the outbreak was known in the U.S., that it was actually circulating largely in Washington and potentially Ohio State, because in Ohio there were an estimated 100,000 cases that basically came out of nowhere. And the CDC official acknowledged that it may have been that physicians had actually thought that it was a case of the flu because they didn't know about the novel coronavirus. So the Chinese Foreign Ministry has taken that CDC admission as a possible acceptance of the fact
that...
Yeah,
play that video right now.
The University of Washington has developed their own tests.
Were those test kits available last Friday?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And without test kits, is it possible that those that have been susceptible to influenza might have been miscategorized as to what they actually had, that it's quite possible that they actually had COVID-19?
The standard practice is the first thing you do is test for influenza. So if they had influenza, they would be positive for influenza.
But only if they were tested. So if they weren't tested, we don't know what they had.
Correct.
Okay. And if somebody dies from influenza, are we doing post-mortem testing to see whether it was influenza or whether it was COVID-19?
There is a surveillance system of death from pneumonia that the CDC has. It's not in every city, every state, every hospital.
So we could have people in the United States dying for what appears to be influenza when, in fact, it could be the coronavirus or COVID-19.
Some cases have been actually diagnosed that way in the United States today.
Thank you.
You know, there's another element to it that I've, you know, been seeing. Nathan Rich has an excellent video where he actually himself says that he doesn't find any substance to the theories so far, and actually provide some contravening evidence. But at the same time, the timeline he puts forward is eerie. And, you know, he points to, and this is what we're hearing from the Chinese Foreign Ministry as well, is, and I looked into it, a strange outbreak of the flu around Maryland and specifically Frederick around the time the CDC had shut down this exercise. at the supposed research bioweapons facility, Fort Detrick. You know, I looked at some local news reports around that time, which was October, again, eerie timeline, where basically you have these local news anchors coming out in Baltimore explaining to people how important it is that they protect themselves against the flu because Maryland has become an epicenter of what they were calling an influenza epidemic, but it was an extreme influenza epidemic. And they're like, here's how you can protect yourself, wash your hands. And a map comes on screen and they say the flu is centered in Maryland and Louisiana. No other states are experiencing it. So that's very odd to me. There were also, I think, Ben, when you referred to Ohio, a lot of those flu cases were initially chalked up to vaping. Or vaping pens, and it led to some kind of restrictions on vaping, which
I was going to ask you guys, in terms of investigative journalism, I think you have a great story if you try to get deeper into this vaping thing.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, because maybe we have some clues. Maybe it was not exactly vaping.
Well, what would, I mean, you know.
I don't know. I'm too far away to... This is something for American reporters to do.
Yeah, I'm always afraid of engaging in these theories, not only because of what it does to my already completely nuclear obliterated reputation with the kind of respectable media, but because it just will like ruin my life because I'll go down a rabbit hole and then I'll never come out.
Well, I gotta say, it's like Epstein. The Epstein stuff will never end. It's like the biggest rabbit hole ever. So I'm so interested in it, but I try to avoid it because I just don't want to destroy my life.
But we know he ran a sex farm for the elite
and was working with intelligence agencies. But it just goes so deep.
This really requires on the ground reporting. It requires a kind of journalistic epidemiology. And right now. I received an alert last night on my phone. I was on a call and the call just dropped because I received a citywide alert telling me to shelter in place until April 24th. Which is kind of like what my life is like already, except I like go to the gym and pick up some beers, but now I just can't do that. You know, that prevents me from doing the kind of journalism that I think is needed where
yeah,
needed.
No, but later, Max. Obviously yeah. Now, but later in the next few months. So now you're having the Chinese system as well. You get your messages on your
exactly
state messages on the phone. Yeah.
So you know where is this heading? I mean, you're on a collision course between the U.S. and China, and whether or not the theories that we've been discussing have any substance, you know, they're out there and it's very offensive to the Trump administration and to the U.S. in general. I mean, it punctures this whole idea of American exceptionalism that is at the heart of this, at the heart of the Cold War, so that our system is just fundamentally superior to China's, you know, techno-fascist Borg. You'll even see liberals kind of using that kind of language on Twitter. So where do you see this heading? I mean, aside from the coronavirus spreading throughout the U.S. and, you know, potentially dooming a million people between the U.S. and China, how could it escalate? We can't see it take the form of a conventional war.
Yeah. Like we were talking before, I think COVID-19 as a particle accelerator, the confrontation that we were expecting would happen around 2030 probably is going to happen in 2020 already, in the next starting in the next few months. Because when you look at, a series of elements, this new posture by Chinese diplomacy, which is now aggressive, and they took their gloves off for the first time, I would say since Mao, they took their gloves off and they're not putting back the gloves again. You know, that's number one. The fact that they believe that their economy is going to start to pick up in the next quarter. So they are going to consolidate in the second quarter the fact that they more or less contained what they call officially the people's war against coronavirus. Supply chains will be back online little by little, which means the rest of Asia that is connected to the supply chains in Asia as well. Even if the supply chains going to the U.S. could be broken or to some parts of Europe, but Asia as a whole is going to start doing business again. Assuming, of course, the imponderables. Now, there is not a deadly second wave of coronavirus, which is something that is already freaking out, especially Hong Kong and Singapore and Japan these past few days. So they have to contain a possible second wave. So the prospects for Asia in the next semester are not bad if it goes on like this. So this means that China will have the economy back on track. For instance, possibility of growing in the third quarter by 15%. Of course, they're going to start from practically zero. Diplomatically, the diplomatic offensive. The goodwill that they are creating, especially inside Europe, this is huge. This is enormous, enormous. In fact, they are contributing to a process that was already ongoing for so long, which is the disaggregation of the European Union. Now we know that the European Union is rotten from the inside and there's no turning back. But there was another example yesterday. The Italian Prime Minister, Conte, which is doing a very good, it's amazing. I never thought this would happen in my life. An Italian prime minister that has over 70% of popular approval in Italy. In every province in Italy. Can you imagine? They for 2,000 years, they've been fighting among themselves nonstop. And now they support their prime minister because, you know, this is a decent guy. And he's caring about our well-being and our interests, you know. So Conte, it's amazing. It's the typical, the guy from nowhere that rises to the occasion by accident or by a twist of fate. Yeah? Anyway, yesterday, for instance, Conte wrote a letter co-signed by other EU nations to the Eurozone as a whole, everybody in the Euro, saying that we need a concerted strategy to fight the recession, assuming already correctly that the recession is already on in Europe. Do you know that 9 countries signed? France, the Club Med, plus Slovenia as well, because it's also Club Med. Belgium, very interesting. And the northern countries did not. So you had 9 countries signing this letter and 10 not signing it, which is a graphic proof of the European Union being completely dismantled. It's impossible to reach any kind of consensus anymore. That's where China comes in, because China, now that they built this ironclad relationship with Italy, it's perfect. Italy is, after Germany and France, is the most important EU economy now with Brexit, right? So they are going to invest all out on solidifying this relationship with Italy and improving their relationship with Germany because of the New Silk Roads, because one of the terminals of the New Silk Roads is the Ruhr Valley in Germany. Very, very important for the Chinese. So if they have these two major branches of the Silk Road through the north, the Ruhr Valley, and through the south in the Mediterranean with the Italian ports, Ravenna, Trieste, Venice, expansion of Venice port financed by the Chinese possibly, that's it. You know, their strategy for solidifying the New Silk Roads in Eastern Europe, which is already working, and now in Central South Europe. So they're going to invest this all out. And this also comes from the top. You know, I have some Italian friends who do the back and forth between Italy and Beijing. They are on it. And they said, yes, and that decision last year by the Italian government to actually be the first G7 nation to actually support or write a memorandum of understanding with the New Silk Roads. They thought about it a long, long time. They said, look, essentially they were saying, What is our future? To be depending on German whims and the European Central Bank, or we're going to have a direct connectivity with the biggest economic power in the world? So they chose to be aligned with the New Silk Road. So this is a very important element. And now to get to the...
Well, Pepe, if I can jump in for 1 second, I also want to read, there's a clip of an article that was published in Politico by Italy's ambassador to the European Union, Maurizio Massari, who wrote this long article about how the EU has completely abandoned Italy. And he wrote, quote, "Unfortunately, not a single EU country responded to the Commission's call. Only China responded bilaterally." And something that you pointed out that I have been repeating, it's a very incredible point. A leftist economist who does work with the left bloc in the EU, which is very tiny, of course, she crunched the numbers and looked at all of the European Commission statements and proclamations between 2011 and 2018. And she found that the European Commission, which is, of course, the group of oligarchs who run the Brussels bureaucrats who run the EU, they called on member states 63 times to cut medical spending and privatize health services over 7 years. 63 times, which, of course, completely decimated the health infrastructure on the continent and help set the stage for this disaster that we're living in right now.
Very, very, very good point, Ben. And that explains what's going on in France at the moment. One of the best healthcare systems on the planet, decimated from the inside by austerity measures approved by the European Commission. In Italy, the same thing. The health system in Lombardy is one of the best in Europe. The same thing. They were... Come on, Bergamo. Bergamo is a very wealthy city in beautiful and wealthy in Lombardy. The same thing. They were after a few days. They said it's impossible. We cannot cope, even with outside help. And this is all linked to those 63 recommendations. When you go to the bloody website of the European Union, when you actually read in Eurocrates. Nobody understands that kind of language, you know, because it's very, very, you know, they're doing something great. No, they're not. They're cutting funds to health systems in Europe. But obviously, it's not written like that, right? And when you talk to the people responsible for health policy in Brussels, at the Commission, the same thing. They don't have a unified health policy. Like they don't have a unified foreign policy to deal with Russia. They don't have a unified energy policy. It's a Kafkaesque mess, in fact. No wonder it's collapsing. Because it's built like Kafka's castle. Literally. You know.
And well,
so China, they're very, very clever. Look at these openings. And they're going to use it.
Absolutely. And Pepe, another country, just before you move away from Europe really quickly, people have been making a lot out of this statement by Serbia's leader, who said that European solidarity is a myth. Serbia is not a member of the EU, but Serbia has been an observer trying to join the EU for several years. Really quickly, I'm wondering if maybe you can explain that, because a lot of people have been highlighting that comment he made, which is incredible, about European solidarity is a myth, only China has helped us. But what's interesting is that the guy who said this is himself a very right-wing leader who's made a lot of anti-Muslim comments. But what's interesting is that I was looking at his history. He used to be a member of a Eurosceptic right-wing party that was against the European Union. But actually, since coming to power, he has been among the right-wingers who have been trying to join the EU. He changed on that position. So what explains Serbia's position there?
It's interesting because in Europe, it's not about ideology anymore. It's about national interests. In fact, why does he want to join the EU? Because he knows there will be a flood of subsidies to Serbia initially, which is the EU's modus operandi. It happened with the Club Med when they joined initially. It's the same thing with a lot of the Eastern Europeans. which but in Eastern Europe, in the end, they were converted into assembly lines for German industry. You know, it's not exactly for the welfare of their own population. So this right winger in Serbia, he's very, very clever. He's counting, okay, there's going to be a flood of money from Brussels if we join. Especially now, not exactly. But the thing is, he thinks he can play both sides, in fact, the Atlanticist side and a more nationalistic side, which I think is impossible. And now what China taught him is that you cannot rely on the EU for anything. And he learned the lesson. And that's why he made that explosive comment. That's the short story about that, you know.
So Italy's always had a kind of independent streak, and after World War II, the U.S. Enacted Operation Gladio to basically prevent Italy from falling into the hands of Stalin. That was the kind of paranoia.
Italian Communist Party, which was too strong.
In fact,
to basically liquidate.
The first CIA operation ever was to manipulate the ninth, to directly meddle in infinitely more than supposed Russian trolls ever did. The CIA in 1948 just rigged the Italian election and handed out like cartoon bags of Monopoly money, just huge bags of cash, paying off the church, and the church excommunicated the Italian communists. They worked with the mafia to break strikes and to rig the election. So, I mean, it was really a colony in the years after World War II.
It still is, Ben and Max. Do you know what the official definition by American generals? And I heard this from I was in Sicily in December when coronavirus was breaking. I was in Sicily. And they told me, they still refer to us as AMGOT, American Government Occupied Territory. I'm not joking. The guys who run that base in Aviano, there's a NATO base in Sigonella in Sicily as well. I drove past. I didn't get in. I will never get a pass to get in. They called Sicily especially and the whole of Italy as AMGOT. And Italians who are not readers of La Stampa or La Corriere della Sera in Milan, they know this very well.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we've seen in, I think it was last year, the Trump administration threatened to sanction even Germany over the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, this acrimony between the U.S. and increasingly independent European states that are kind of chomping at the bit to move out of this transatlantic vice intensifying in ways I never expected to see at this stage. Let's say China begins to start filling the void. And, you know, this Silk Road becomes consolidated more rapidly than expected. What does the U.S. do to retaliate, given its history of sort of sabotage?
Wow, that's a very good question, Max. I would say, first of all, cyber war, which may have already started. The U.S. has absolutely no capability to try to start a confrontation in the South China Sea, for instance, or because of Taiwan. But cyber war is another story. It would be, in terms of hybrid war, their best strategy. And the Chinese are very much aware of it as well. It could be a biological war as well. That's why they are entertaining the working hypothesis for Dietrich Wuhan military games event 101. Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, now we are on a race against time, in fact. How fast will the Chinese economy recover and the supply chains are back online and they extend their international goodwill offensive, especially in Europe, but also with the neighbors here in Southeast Asia and in Central Asia. and they have at least part of the global economy functioning again. How fast will be the deterioration inside the U.S. because of COVID-19, which can be an absolute nightmare, compounded with these elections in November, which may even be postponed if there is some sort of martial law going on in the U.S., not dissimilar to the Latin American dictatorships of the 70s. This is a working hypothesis again, but plausible. So it's a mix of the deterioration of the empire on one side and the ascension, but with lots of bumps on the road, of the next number one economic power on the other side. So, if you see a G7 yesterday, a G20 today, at the center, you cannot have a consensus because these two will be fighting. It's a perpetual cat fight now on every international forum, on the net, on Twitter, you name it. And, of course, underground, CIA, black ops, possible cyber war and biological war. So the Chinese now, they have identified that they were under what they described, not in with this terminology, but in the sense that this was a full spectrum dominance war against China. Last year already, even before, in fact, during the trade war, I would say around August, September last year, after the Boao Forum, which they usually have middle of the year, after they have that retreat of the leadership in August, they go to discuss what's going to happen next, etc. So around August, September last year, they already had formulated, okay, so how are we going to respond to that? So now we are seeing on the diplomatic front the new face of China. We still don't know how it's going to be the new economic face of China when the economy starts to pick up. Or if they're going to say trade war in the United States, we don't care. We if you don't give us what we want as well, we're not going to sign anything with you. We don't need it. And if they do this, it's because their trade with Europe is more important than their trade with the U.S., which is not the case yet. And then there's a very, very important angle, which is energy market.
Pepe, before we move to energy, that's super important, and I want you to talk about that. But just while we're talking about the new Cold War, I think what's really interesting about this is that this is a point that Max and I and the Gray Zone, we've been talking about for over a year now, because there were two major things that, of course, didn't really get major attention in corporate media. The most important, I mean, the trade war did get attention, the Trump's trade war with China, and that seems to be part of this larger strategy of what people call economic decoupling, and that's related to energy markets we can talk about in a second. So that did get some coverage, the strategy to try to decouple the Chinese economy, which is so closely integrated to the U.S. economy. But then something else that I think was even more important that didn't get much attention was right after Trump entered office, the Pentagon, not necessarily, I think, at Trump's request, because these are Pentagon folks who are part of the national security state who don't change with the president. And the Pentagon strategists published the new national security strategy, which was the first U.S. national security strategy since the so-called War on Terror. And they declared that the new so-called threats to U.S. national security are great power competition. They have their own acronym now, GPC, and China and Russia, of course, are those main supposed threats. And we have seen in the past several months, well before anyone ever heard of the new coronavirus, we saw, for instance, the British ultra-conservative historian Neil Ferguson, who is kind of the leading pro-colonialist historian. He teaches at Harvard University. He's married to the Islamophobe neocon Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And Neil Ferguson, who has written many books talking about how great the British Empire was, he recently, several months ago, published an op-ed in the New York Times titled, "The New Cold War, It's with China, and It Has Already Begun." And of course, he's talking about why it's good that the new Cold War has begun with China.
Yeah, I know. Ferguson is, despicable. I prefer not even to talk. And I took the trouble to read some of his books, especially Civilization.
since you brought him up, just in a funny aside, maybe some of our listeners might appreciate it, but I wrote a piece exposing his wife, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, as a fraud, that her life story was largely consisted of fabrications which had already been exposed in the Netherlands, which accounted for her leaving and taking up a fellowship at the neoconservative American Enterprise Institute. She was basically fleeing from her own disgrace. And he hired it appears that he hired a student at Brandeis University who had organized the honoring of Ayaan Hirsi Ali there to write a series of attack pieces on me in the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol's publication, and a bunch of other, The Spectator and places like that. And it came out that Ferguson was actually, where is he, at Harvard? Or I think it was at Harvard. He actually was hiring other students on campus and paying people to attack fellow faculty members. So, I mean, this really, it's a perfect kind of encapsulation of a really decadent kind of faux intellectual elite. Anyway, it's just a funny aside since his name came up.
But the illustration is excellent, Max. This is how it works with these people. Especially Americans that gave at a British academic, you know, they're still, it's our colonial masters. You know?
Yeah, it's really weird how Americans think all Brits are smart because they have a British accent. It's so strange.
I always said that if Niall Ferguson had like a South Carolina accent, he's like, you know, them colored folk, they just don't know how to, they don't know how to think right, you know. It would just be all over. Anyway, we were on something about great power competition.
Well, Niall Ferguson's the one pushing this idea that we're in a new Cold War really hard, and he says it's good. And of course, we also have published stuff about at the Gray Zone about Jimmy Lai, the Hong Kong right-wing oligarch who's viciously anti-China, and he says it too.
Yeah, in fact, when I was writing about Hong Kong last year, I went there twice, and the second time it was crazy because the editor of Asia Times asked me, try to find out who's behind these black blocks here. I said, well, it's very easy. 3 days later, I had the whole story for him, and I said, and one of the guys who's paying them is Jimmy Lai. And it's crazy because everybody in Hong Kong who has connections knows that Jimmy Lai is one of the CIA's top guys in Hong Kong for 20 years, at least.
He was meeting with John Bolton.
Of course. That famous photo with Jimmy Lai with John Bolton. 1 billion Chinese saw that photo. So everybody knew what's going on in Hong Kong, especially because of the Jimmy Lai connection. And obviously because they also read the Apple Daily. Apple Daily is also read in mainland China. So, you know, they know what he's all about. But why did you bring up Jimmy Lai as a sort of a fifth columnist inside Hong Kong? Was that
Well, no. Because Jimmy Lai did an interview with CNN. And CNN did a big puff profile about how amazing this pro-democracy advocate is. Just PR for him. But in the interview that he did with CNN, Jimmy Lai said explicitly, he said, the U.S., has a new Cold War, and it's with China. And he said, we in Hong Kong, of course, he's actually only a minority tendency within Hong Kong because there are a lot of people in Hong Kong who support Beijing. But he claims to CNN that we here are on the front lines of the new Cold War against China. And of course, he uses this clash of civilizations rhetoric, claiming that China doesn't share the values that the U.S. has. So well before coronavirus, they were already using this new Cold War rhetoric.
Yeah. And this framed the coverage of the whole mainstream media in the U.S., in fact, that this intervention, absolutely, because they needed a Hong Konger to say that to American media. That's perfect. You know, you have your guy. You have your your loudspeaker, you know, a local loudspeaker. And he is absolutely detested in Hong Kong, even, well, especially by the Hong Kong elites, which are very business-minded. And they know that what he was doing was very bad for business. I heard this from one of the top businessmen in Hong Kong when I was there in September. He told me, look, we know this guy's bad for business. We have to get rid of this thing. He's killing our economy. These were his words, literally. And that's exactly what was happening. And they managed to kill Hong Kong's economy between June and September, especially the height of the protests. And now with the COVID-19, you know, Hong Kong is absolutely over. And the Chinese already knew that. Even with that fabulous plan that they had, the Greater Bay Area, which is to unite the big cities in Guangdong Province in the south with the high-speed rail, with that fabulous 55-kilometer bridge with Hong Kong. And then after 4 months of protests, it's fantastic. They had a special task force in Shenzhen across the border monitoring everything that was happening. And they were also talking to the business leadership in Hong Kong as well. They were identifying the protesters, the leaders, etc. And they were talking to Hong Kong. And they said, look, we don't care. Well, they had their dossier, everything that happened. Now they have the full story. You went to Beijing, was studied. And I said, okay, if they don't want to be part of the development of southern China, it's okay. We don't care. We're going to concentrate, especially in Shenzhen. And Shenzhen now is more important to China than Hong Kong, because Shenzhen is also a mini Silicon Valley, especially because of Huawei and Tencent. You know, they are in Shenzhen. So they don't care about Hong Kong. It's up to Hong Kong now to tell the Chinese leadership, yes, we want to have our economies integrated. We want to develop along with you. Otherwise, you can leave it. Okay, you want to go back to the British Empire? We don't care.
Well, Pepe, just to push back a little bit, I mean, obviously, you know, you have all these sources and what you're saying is true, but I think to say that they don't care, I mean, they do care about the political symbol because they're afraid that if Hong Kong is taken away from China and returned to the Western imperial orbit, that's part of the beginning of the balkanization strategy to carve up China, right?
Yeah. I know you're right, Ben. I said that in jest, of course. As a figure
well,
of speech.
Well, and economically, Hong Kong is not that important. It's politically important.
Exactly, but they presented to not only to Carrie Lam. Carrie Lam, she cannot manage a high school. Can you imagine a society as complex as Hong Kong? Basically, they sent the message to the ultra wealthy multi-billionaires that run the Hong Kong business. More or less in these terms, look, we would love to have you working with us. If your political decision in Hong Kong is not to work with us, it's okay. This is what they said essentially, you know, which is a very, very serious message, because they know they don't need Hong Kong as the middleman between the West and China like it was until the handover or a few years after the handover. They know that Shanghai is more important than Hong Kong as a financial capital because they want to build Shanghai as the financial capital of China. Hong Kong has no high-tech value for Hong Kong because the high-tech value is in Shenzhen and in that other Silicon Valley near Beijing. So, you know, in terms of the interaction between China and the West, Hong Kong still has a role to play. And the businesses in Hong Kong, they understood the message. And they said, no, let's get rid of these protest leaders. And that's what happened before COVID-19. This is what they were doing. They were putting these people in jail.
Yeah.
And they were already thinking, okay, we're going to be back in business as Hong Kong business now in 2020. And now they have COVID-19 in their faces. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We also... did an episode with Carl Zha, who made many of these same points, that Hong Kong had sort of deteriorated as an economic hub, and that animated a lot of the resentment of the youth and their glorification of the colonial past, that they had no economic future, so they looked to the good old days of British colonialism. I want to switch from the east of China to the west of China, to the Xinjiang region, and get your view on that. Xinjiang seems very geopolitically significant because it shared so many borders. It's at the center of Eurasia. And, you know, from the imperial perspective, you know, you control the great world island of Eurasia and you control the world. And so we've seen a clear effort to destabilize Xinjiang. I don't know about the extent to which, you know, the U.S. and Western powers are involved there, but you have had a separatist movement, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement and the Turkestan Islamic Party is active in Idlib, in northwest Syria, which is sort of the base of Al-Qaeda and 31 flavors of Salafi jihadi. They're probably the most extreme faction active there. And China has sought to suppress what is a separatist insurgency that had carried out several mass casualty events, which could be considered terrorism. They are using mass surveillance, and now China is accused of having concentration camps containing millions of Uyghur Muslims. You know, we broke down the sources behind that and showed that really didn't amount to much, very dubious sourcing. We have a new piece up at the Gray Zone on, you know, the forced labor story, which is obviously sort of a part of the PR blitz around Xinjiang, which aims to separate a lot of the, you know, corporate supply lines from China, to kind of force companies to disinvest in China. You know, I'm kind of like laying out my view of the situation there. Do you agree? And I guess, can you address the geopolitical significance of this Western semi-autonomous region of China, Xinjiang, which is also, you know, contains a population that sees itself as sort of ethnic Turkestani or ethnic Turkish and has close relations with Turkey as well?
Yes. Look, we could talk about this for hours, man.
Yeah.
I am a huge fan culturally. And historically, not to mention politically, of Xinjiang, especially because when at the height of the Uyghur Empire in the 7th, 8th century, that kind of stuff. I'm going to use this in my next book, which is going to be about the New Silk Road, and I'm going to talk about history a lot, and I have to trace back the history of Xinjiang, which is not Xinjiang. Now, it was Eastern Turkestan, as it was always known. And yes, they are Turkophone people. They were a conquering people. They have a very, very proud tradition as warriors. It's nowadays for us, it's extremely complicated. You know, before COVID-19 exploded, one of the things that I was preparing was my own trip to Xinjiang, possibly in the first semester. But in my case, it's very complicated because the Chinese know that I am a journalist. They read my stuff. I am in their files. I am a journalist working for a publication based in Hong Kong. So it's a nightmare. I would have to find a way to do some traveling.
Wait, Pepe, you're telling me that you're actually independent and you're not just a secret CPC plant or a Kremlin plant like we're all smeared as these days?
I know, there are a lot. You have no idea. I receive that every day in spades, that I am a CPC mole, that I am a shield for C, you name it. I don't give a fuck. Really, I don't care.
That's the right attitude.
I have
That's
been
how we
accused
feel too.
In my professional life of everything. At the time when I was writing about the invasion of Afghanistan, I was actually believed in by many Americans to be a Taliban mole.
Oh, God.
I'm not joking. Or an Al-Qaeda double agent. And then I became an Iraqi agent. Then I became a Putinista. So it comes with the territory, and you guys
yeah.
know about it. So, but to come back to Xinjiang. So because I've been to Xinjiang a few times, but before these past few years. So I traveled the whole Silk Road from Xi'an to the border, the Xinjiang borders with Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. This past, 2 months ago, in November, December, I was on three Xinjiang borders. First, I was on the Tajik Xinjiang border because I was traveling the Pamir Highway. First I was in the Kazakh, the most important one, the Kazakh Xinjiang border, which is the number one border for those trains that come from China and then go all the way to Europe. That was an absolutely fascinating experience. You can find these articles on Asia Times, of course. And one of them I wrote specifically about the border, which is one of the nodes of the New Silk Road. So you have three borders. One border for the trucks, which is plenty of cargo trucks both ways. One border for pedestrians, which is fascinating because they come from all over Kazakhstan and some parts of Central Asia by bus. They stop at the border. The formalities take 5 minutes, and they go to the other side where you have five huge shopping malls. They shop till they drop, and then they cross the border back, put the whole load on their buses, and go back to Central Asia. Fascinating. So this is a node. And the most important one, which is the railway, which is going to become a high-speed railway within the next 10 years. And then you have those trains that come from Eastern China or Southeast China or from Chongqing, crossing through Kazakhstan and then going all the way to Europe. So you see these nuts and bolts of the New Silk Road in action. Fascinating. I was on the Central Asian side. I was not on the Xinjiang side. But and all the people, all the Uyghurs that I talked to in Kazakhstan, then in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan, where I stayed for quite a while, and there are a lot of Uyghurs there, modern-style Uyghur businessmen doing business with the Central Asian countries. And from their view, these people were middle class, upper middle class. Let's say the Uyghur bourgeoisie. They were going back and forth. They say, well, it's complicated because, you know, we're here, formalities, passport, etc. But we live here, we can work here, no problems, etc. When they go back to China, there are lots of questions, etc. And they say, look, what the Chinese government is doing, they are trying to root out the people who are indoctrinated Wahhabi style to become jihadists. This is very, very different from having 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. Very, very different. Which is very similar to what they did in Tibet. And this is something that I saw for myself in Tibet years ago. The Communist Party chief was in charge of Tibet. Their policy, without trying to antagonize the Tibetan population, was to try to identify those people who were more or less on their way to becoming a guerrilla force. And the Chinese are very good at identifying guerrilla forces, you know, the Chinese communists. What they're trying to do in Xinjiang is to try to identify these people who were indoctrinated online especially, but also through madrasas. In Xinjiang, they were financed by who else? Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So if you go to some small cities in the Silk Road, there are two branches of the Silk Road before it gets to Kashgar, the northern branch and the Silk branch. There are a lot of villages on both sides. They are all Uyghur, 99%, of course. They have their little mosque and all that. And Saudi Arabia, they financed many of these mosques. So the Chinese, they center on these mosques and say, okay, who's the imam? Who are these guys? What are
well,
they
Well, I would imagine, doesn't Turkey so fund some of these mosques too?
Yes, Turkey does. But what Turkey financed, that's an enormous
difference. Yeah, because Turkey is more aligned with the Muslim
Turkey
Brotherhood.
Muslim Brotherhood style mosque and a Saudi Arabia hardcore
who
Wahhabi
are anti-Muslim Brotherhood.
Mosque.
Yeah,
and this is something that I have seen from Mali to Indonesia in my travels this past 20 years. Even before 9/11, I could see this in a lot of places. Saudi money indoctrinating young people. The Turks, of course, because they are Turkophone people, brotherhood, etc. But they are more concentrated in the big cities. So if you go to Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, there's a lot of Turkish involvement. Turkish construction companies, you name it, and Turkish money invested in Urumqi. And Urumqi is also, I don't know if many of you know, it's also a high-tech hub. It's amazing. It's a modern Chinese city in the middle of the Xinjiang Desert, which is not only a node of the New Silk Roads, but it's also they're building as a high-tech hub as well. Not to mention the oil and gas pipelines that go through Xinjiang. So it's extremely complex. You cannot reduce it to 1 million people in a concentration camp. It's much more complicated than that. And their relationship, the Chinese relationship with the neighbors, they have been investing it heavily on it. And they're making a lot of mistakes. For instance, I was talking to a former foreign minister of Kyrgyzstan. And then I asked him, can you name me one or two or three fabulous projects that the Chinese invested with transfer of technology in Kyrgyzstan? And he said, zero. So they are making big mistakes. You know, it's they need what the Chinese call a win-win relationship, but a win-win for the small and much weaker countries that are their neighbors. With Kazakhstan, it's more complicated. Kazakhstan is a big power. So, and Kazakhstan is a member of the New Silk Roads and the Eurasian Economic Union, which is Russia. So Kazakhstan is a sort of bridge between Russia and China, and also part of the Chinese a big vision. But the other ones, they're small countries, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, they're fragile, just like Laos and Cambodia in Southeast Asia. When you go to Laos, for instance, I went to see the high-speed rail that they are building in the middle of the jungle, literally crossing the Mekong. And I was talking to the wonderful Laos people in Luang Prabang. They're saying, okay, but what is in it for us? It's going to be a very expensive fast train. We cannot afford it, you know. So the Chinese are still not seeing this distribution of wealth angle, but they are learning fast, and I'm sure it's going to change. So they're going to direct their companies to hire more local labor, you know, you name it. But Xinjiang itself for them is a matter of mega national security, even more than Tibet. Tibet, because of the border with India, as we know, because they have untold wealth in minerals, it's because they have sometimes they used to have nuclear tests as well. And Xinjiang, because there's a lot of oil, that it's unexplored oil in Xinjiang as well. And because it's the connection between Western China with the rest of Asia. So they have to pay special attention to Xinjiang, and they simply cannot afford to have a separatist movement over there. If we can debate endlessly about the morality of the whole operation. I always try to understand their geostrategic priorities. And they came up with a plan that is developing Xinjiang, but Chinese style. This means the Uyghurs, they have to assimilate into Han culture. And then they're going to have job opportunities. They're going to be inside the new digital economy in Xinjiang as well. And that's it. So, or if you want to be aligned with a team, the separatist movement, then you're going to have a really hard life, and your possibilities of succeeding are going to be zero, because you have at least, 500,000-600,000 PLA soldiers patrolling Xinjiang everywhere. The last time I was there, I remember very well, It starts at the airport in Urumqi. Everywhere you go and everywhere you look is heavily policed, cameras everywhere, you name. So it is a Orwellian-like atmosphere. It is oppressive. I totally understand the Uyghur point of view. For instance, what they did to Kashgar. Kashgar, they destroyed the medieval center of Kashgar, and they built practically a replica Chinese city. It's horrible when you look at it. Urumqi, the same thing. Urumqi is a big, big, big generic eastern Chinese city transplanted to the middle of the desert, 4,000 kilometers away from Beijing. It's very impressive to watch something like this. And this gives you shows you the power of the state. They can do anything they want. In fact, it's once again, an Orwellian element. But then you try to see things on the ground and say, okay, what do they want to achieve? It's still that same old Maoist notion of equality for all, development for everybody, etc. You know, just it's what they think they did for Tibet, and it's what they think they're doing for Xinjiang. You know, so we have to try to understand their motivations. It's not a matter of defending their official policies, no, but it's trying to understand geostrategically what they're trying to do. If they don't have a peaceful Xinjiang, they cannot have a working New Silk Road. It's simple as that.
I mean, I see so much of what we do and our work is kind of providing balance, making media more fair and balanced, because when we hear these constant discussions of Xinjiang, for example, of so many issues, there is not only no balance, or, you know, liberals love nuance. There is none. And they say, you know, you have to look at the complexities, but there is no complexity there. Because the geostrategic motivations of China or the national security motivations are never discussed in any of the articles about the supposed Holocaust-level human rights atrocities being committed. So the reader is left to believe that China is simply seeking to indoctrinate minorities for the pure sake of communist indoctrination. And they're left with a scene out of Red Dawn with people in camps being like, indoctrinated into Chinese communist culture through iron-plated megaphones. I think that's a simplistic point of view, even if you can also acknowledge that there is a gigantic surveillance state that's been implemented there. We have to ask why. And so, you know, I appreciate the answer you gave there, because it kind of provides the why. You know, I had wanted this year to actually travel there, but I think it would be very difficult, as you pointed out, to travel there as a journalist. And, you know, for us, for me or Ben, if we had gone there, you know, for us to be able to make an impact or to be able to explain the situation back in the West, all of our work would simply be dismissed as, government PR, that we were led there by government minders. I mean, that was what already was done when I went to Damascus, even though I didn't have government minders. I was simply, you know, going around the Damascus district as a free person. But, you know, the perspective is that any journalism that's done there that provides any alternative perspective than the kind of single monotonous anti-China chorus that is being pumped through CNN and the New York Times is, you know, government controlled. And I wonder if, you know, it is possible to go there and see things for yourself. So far, we have seen only, you know, the BBC, I think, go to one of these sort of de-radicalization centers or schools that are set up that are portrayed as concentration camps. They didn't really find anything particularly unsavory or hideous going on there. But then, you know, obviously it was a sort of staged managed visit. And what they were shown, for example, were Uyghur youth doing some dance classes. And I saw on Twitter, someone zeroed in on the face of one of the youth who seemed to be happily dancing in this BBC footage. And it looked, they said he has a black eye. This is ridiculous. Like, basically, they've been like brutally beaten into dancing for the cameras, and it wasn't even clear to me that he had a black eye. This is a BuzzFeed reporter. Oh. And then, you know, Chris Hayes from MSNBC chimes in and said, horrible, you know, this is horrific. And, you know, that becomes the essence of the BBC report. So it's almost like it's impossible to present back to the West any alternative perspective in a place that is, you know, under heavy government state control. And so anyway, I can't go anywhere now, but I'd always had that feeling about, you know, what is the point of even trying to show something different from there?
What I'm going to try to do when I go, I'm going to sell it as a cultural trip. I'm going to tell them, look, I'm going to retrace the ancient Silk Roads because I'm writing a book about it. And our connections in Shenzhen told me, look, try. We're going to back you up and let's see if it works. That's one possibility, you know.
Yeah.
And because then you're not going to have minders with you 24/7. They're going to have to pre-approve your itinerary, but maybe you have the leeway to catch a train or book your own bus ride, whatever, you know. It's possible.
Right.
It's something that you can do, for instance, in Tibet. In Tibet, when you go to Tibet, you have to book a tour. You get some idiot that goes to pick you up at Lhasa Airport. You stay with him the first day, and the next day, you lose him. And then you do everything you want by yourself.
Right.
And he won't find you.
Right.
So something that can be done in Xinjiang. Xinjiang is much more complicated, but it's doable as well. If you have a simple tourist visa.
Thank you for. I'm gonna try to pursue that recommendation in 2022 when the plague is over.
assuming we all survive.
Yeah.
Assuming
after
civilization
I've, you know,
still
eaten
exists,
my cat and. but we're coming up on 2 hours, Ben. Is there anything else you want to?
Yeah. Well, Pepe, we can just conclude here. I mean, there's so much more to explore, and actually, hopefully.
Do another one whenever you can, guys. In the near future.
We should do something in the future. In fact, I was just about to say, hopefully we can have you as a regular guest, because I think, you know, here at Moderate Rebels, at the Gray Zone too, but especially at Moderate Rebels, we like to kind of get wonky, if you will, and talk about detailed geopolitics and history. So you're the perfect guest for that.
Oh man, I was always a rebel since my teen, so that's my
well.
Wonk isn't a word that comes to mind when I think of Pepe Escobar, but
well,
I think of Elizabeth Warren or something.
Yeah, well, wonky.
Well, I'm a
schmuck, I don't know what term to use. I mean, political nerds. We go into detail in a way that corporate media never goes into detail. But just wrapping up.
Because first of all, they are not interested, and second, they don't even know how to start. They don't have enough.
Well,
information.
Because the only information they have is fed to them by the Pentagon or State Department.
It's fed to them, and they don't have the leeway to confront information coming from all sides as well. You know, so it's very narrow-minded, and I see it as extremely provincial and narrow-minded.
Absolutely. I mean, it's. You know, we're in an information space here in Washington where the U.S. government has just halved the staff of Chinese state broadcasters and, you know, slapped RT with the Foreign Agent Registration Act, which really neutered them. And, you know, if you watch RT America right now, they're not even covering the U.S. election because they're so afraid of being accused of meddling. So, I mean, it's just about all of that is about keeping America dumb, keeping Americans parochial minded, and shutting off, you know, alternative non-hegemonic points of view. And anyone who goes on any of these networks now, I mean, and they've had such a wide variety of guests who present all sorts of different perspectives over the year, much more diverse than U.S. media. You're just dismissed. Even for being a guest. So, I mean, I think it emphasizes the importance of what we're doing in an independent sphere to bring different voices together. But yeah, there's been a clear attempt, particularly in the past 3 years, to really shut down, you know, discussion or alternative forms of information to make it less available to the U.S. public, to remove these stations from U.S. airwaves, from cable. It's paying off. It's paying off. Look at Trump's approval rating going up as he has allowed this pandemic to spread. Look at the most hated institution in the U.S. is the media. So,
well, rightfully.
rightfully so. But I mean, it's because people know they're being dumbed down, but at the same time, they don't know where to begin to find out anything else. Where can we follow you in your work? Where can our listeners follow you?
Well, I'm still writing for Asia Times. So I write for Asia Times roughly twice a week. Consortium News as well, regularly. I wish I could have more time for Consortium News specials, but usually at least two a month. And Strategic Culture in Moscow, they're very small, but they're wonderful people. They have a fabulous collection of writers who are writing for them. So I write for them once or twice a month as well. And I don't have time for more than that. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Because some of my articles, they are very complicated. It involves...
No, every paragraph is, very voluminous and packed with research and,
Packed research with two people. I try always to have some inside info. So these things are... So I'm very privileged because over the years, you have a network, a global network, in fact. So I have great people feeding me fabulous.
Yeah, and Pepe, I also have to say, I've been reading your columns for years, and one of the things that I also find very refreshing is they're very literary. You're clearly a cultured man. You reference, the arts and culture, and it's so much more interesting than a lot of dry geopolitical analysis.
In fact, if I would one day have to define myself, I am a reader.
It's clear in your writing, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good writers are big readers.
Well, Confucius said, remember Confucius, no? He said, and other Chinese scholars, one of them, I can't remember now, he said that the best pleasure of life was wake up in the morning and embrace his library. Beautiful.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to transition to a conclusion here. This is Ben Norton.
And then go back to our phones and not read.
Back to quarantine for the next who knows how long. But I'm Ben Norton, joined by my co-host Max Blumenthal, and we were speaking with Pepe Escobar, who is one of the best geopolitical analysts out there. Definitely check out his regular columns at the Asia Times. And we hope to have Pepe back as a regular guest here at Moderate Rebels. If you want to support the work that we do, you can go to patreon.com/moderaterebels to support us. As always, for those of us watching on YouTube, thanks for watching. And for those listening to the podcast, thanks for listening. You can catch us again sometime soon for more coronavirus coverage from quarantine. And we're out.